Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome back to part two of this powerful episode of Women of Impact with the world's number one narcissist expert, Dr. Romani. And guys, we just keep freaking digging deeper into the complex emotions and feelings that come up when you're in a toxic relationship and how to actually heal from the abuse. We talk about how confusion and despair in the relationship will wear down your spirit and energy for life. And then we finally talk about how to move on with the help of Dr. Romani's Recover from the Lying method. I'm your host, Lisa Billy, and you're listening to Women of Impact. But before we dive in, guys, why don't you hit that rate and review button? You have no idea how that type of thing makes a difference to spreading the word of this podcast. So if this episode or any other episode that you've ever listened to of Women of Impact has actually impacted you, then please do let us know by subscribing and rating this podcast. All right, now let's get to the episode with my girl, Dr. Romani, on Women of Impact. Oh, we just touched on self-blame. So we're going to go to the next one, which is another emotion that I think can really trip us up, is shame.
Shame is sort of the mothership in narcissistic relationships, because both the narcissistic person is feeling shame and the person in the relationship is feeling shame for very different reasons. So the narcissistic person, part of the reason their behavior is so problematic is all of this shame, right? For them, the shame is that they will be found out to not be perfect, to not be the most powerful, right? It's as though someone's going to come and take off their Superman cape and they're just going to be a regular person. That's the source of their shame. Because they feel so much shame and it's unprocessed, they project it onto everybody else. So anybody who's in a relationship with a narcissistic person is in the splash zone of their shame. Then you have the person in the relationship who feels shame at being in a relationship that's unhealthy, who feels shame at not being able to express their needs, who feels shame that they are keeping their relationship secret from other people because it looks ridiculous, who feels shame that they don't have the courage to leave or they're not leaving, who feels shame that they're thinking terrible thoughts about someone they're supposed to love and that they're disloyal. So the shame that's happening for the survivor is quite different than the shame that's happening for the narcissist. We never behave well when we're experiencing shame. Shame is sort of it's a public emotion, right? It's the feeling judged about the things we've done that are quote unquote bad, but we're often taking things that aren't necessarily bad things, like feeling like we can't share our relationship because it'll be judged, because we're afraid it'll be judged. That's the public piece of it. That's the shame, right? Shame leads people to hide. Shame leads people to act out. Shame is probably the core of all bad behavior on the planet. If we could address shame, that's Brené Brown's entire body of work, then we would be in a much better place. But the shame of the survivor is made worse because there's people in the world who are saying, you're overblowing this narcissistic thing. You have no right to diagnose your partner or your parent or whoever the hell this person is. Why don't you just leave them? What's wrong with you? All of that drives their shame.
So in those, knowing all of the drivers of shame and that when you're in a narcissistic relationship, you have probably more of that, even more so, right? Because like you broke down, you're hiding things, you're having to, lessen yourself, especially if, let's even say, in the public eye, you're seen as this really strong, badass woman. That must be even freaking harder.
Oh, it's terrible. I'm so glad you brought up that point about people who, to the world, look badass, strong, tough. The number of like, it's interesting. Even in Hollywood, the celebrity world, more and more people are coming out and being transparent about their narcissistic relationships. Sometimes they're calling them emotionally abusive, but you're seeing people talk about it. People who seem like the most together, the most with it, like top of their game, worth a gazillion trillion dollars, are like, you're going through this too? And I think that this is what we need to remember, is that while I think that the impacts of this are far, far worse for people who don't have resources because they don't have therapists they can turn to, they don't have lawyers to help with divorces, they don't have new apartments they can move to, they don't have those things. So they often have to endure it. They don't have the support they need, all of that, that it still operates the same way. And that I think sometimes when you are sort of up here and you're going through this, the shame about, I should be smarter than this, right? It isn't about smart. Nobody is being taught this. And you know how I feel about this. I think that the field of mental health has let people who are in these relationships down. We haven't given them the vocabulary. We're more quick to shame people like, well, I don't know. Like, let's not get so focused on their personality. Let's focus on you. No, let's not focus on me. If I go outside and I get wet because it's raining, it's because it's raining. It's not because there's something about me that's creating wet. It's the same thing, that you're in this relationship with this person. They're an issue. They're the stimulus. And listen, the good therapist will talk about it. They'll say, yo, your husband sounds like narcissistic. And that will give the person saying, okay, I'm not crazy. Like, thank you so much. That can literally take therapy and push fast forward button for like 6 months worth of work. And now you've got something to work with. People say, okay, I'm not out of my mind. And Lisa, people say, how do you know? They're just telling you their side of the story. Something changed since I trained to be a therapist. And now, which is now there are cell phones. People say, take a look at this email. And you can tell it's from someone else. I can see, and I'll read the email. And I'll think like, it's almost so that there must be some narcissism AI generator that's generating these emails because they all read the same way, you know? And I'm like, it's very clear. They will bring in emails. They will bring in text messages. They will bring in voice recordings. It is unmistakable to me that the person they're in a relationship with is narcissistic.
It never dawned on me that you personally didn't even have that back in the early days.
No, when I first started training in graduate school, it was the early 1990s. And we didn't have none of this. I mean, you'd be having to walk around with a tape recorder in your pocket. Remember how used to big
yes, geez, you can hide shit.
like this massive thing on your belt or something. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have, I mean, unless people, no, it's not going to have a letter. You know what I'm saying? Like, no one's going to, I guess every so often maybe someone had a letter, but it's not like the Quicksilver communication. So we didn't have that. And I think that the existence of that has changed the game for us almost having an evidence base, like read these texts. And they'll almost watch my face go from like, you know, they'll watch and I'll say, this is horrifying. And they'll say, I'm so used to getting texts like this that it's not even registering as horrifying to me anymore.
So new technology like text has actually helped us.
It has helped and harmed us, right? Because I think what it's done is it's created one more tool for them to engage abusively. Where it's helped in therapy is it's given us the evidence base of what's happening in this relationship. Because when we talk about something, it changes. But I have one client who would just keep bringing in these voice recordings. And literally I say, you know, we only have 50 minutes. And the client would say, I don't care. We're going to spend 20 minutes listening. This client would press play. And I would make notes and it was horrifying. But the client said, watching your face as you listen to this was healing for me. Because this is what I've grown up with. This is all I've ever known. And for you to hear this and for me to see this on your face, I now know I'm not crazy. You know, the problem is that people will bring in the email, the recording or the text, and they'll say, I'm embarrassed. I'm so ashamed. You know, because basically they're like, I'm still in this. And look at this, you know, so it doesn't necessarily alleviate it. It's just it's more of a validation, but that shame piece is deep. And a lot of people feel as though, because the narcissistic gaslighting will leave them feeling as though they're part of the problem. They're complicit in this. They're engaging in this. In fact, that they might even be a terrible person because they're thinking disloyal thoughts. That they're saying, I hate my father, or I wish I never met this horrible man that I married or something. And the challenge is that those thoughts leave people wondering if they're just terrible people. And that's a concept we call moral injury. The idea that somebody feels like they did a bad thing.
Actually, and even just thinking even through this, I would think about as if I was to replay, I think part of me would beat myself up for not having said something different or, you know, like if you're hearing the abuse and then you hear, or if I had then heard myself saying, okay, you know, like I think that would dredge up some uncomfortable feelings that I didn't stand up for myself, that I didn't push back. And then I think that actually would probably cause more shame for me.
And that's the challenge. And so this is where the education part of working for me, working with clients who are experiencing narcissistic abuse is, these are the reasons why you didn't respond. There's a reason for this. And that's that nervous system stuff and those nervous system responses and that sense of safety and the fact it's going to go nowhere. When people have a map for why they kept hitting the walls they were hitting, it helps them feel like, okay, this is actually how I behaved is what's to be expected, kind of thing.
So the other emotions that we have to embrace during this period that you said that you've really eloquently spoke about and written about your book is confusion and despair.
So confusion, as somebody you love is being invalidating, and then you have a nice weekend, and then they scream at you on Tuesday. The confusion is it's the backing and forthing, right? It's the just as a person's like, this is a terrible relationship, I need to get out. It's exactly what Rebecca's analogy was. They catch you at just as you're about to hit the ground from the 100 stories up, right? So it's that being pushed off and being caught, being pushed off and being caught, that the person's like, I don't know what I'm supposed to feel. And we have this, especially the longer term, the relationship, the life that's, we have this life together and we have this together and we've been through this together. And especially if you have things like kids, any of those things that can really bulk up that connective tissue, people are confused. Am I to blame? Are they right? They told me I'm losing my mind. Maybe I am. I do have a history of depression. Maybe that's why I'm like this. You know, I don't pay attention. I've been distracted. Maybe I'm disorganized. On and on and on. It is an indoctrination process. So people are confused. They'll have moments where like, this doesn't seem right. But then they'll have moments of like, no, it's right. And then you add to that, people don't want to change the status quo, that they are afraid of like what would happen if they ended it. They're afraid what would happen if they stayed in it. So people are chronically confused. And because of that confusion, they start to believe that they're somehow impaired. And that plays into that gaslighting.
And so how about the despair?
Well, the despair is this idea that it's never going to get better. It's never going to change. I'm always going to suffer. And here's where people might be suffering, frank depression, pretty severe anxiety. At the most severe, there might be people who are even experiencing sort of thoughts of self-harm or ending their life, you know, in which case it is absolutely essential that a person seek out emergency services, whether that's calling 911, checking themselves into a hospital, whatever it is, it's getting help immediately, because this can bring up that sense of helplessness. And people going even through these divorce procedures will say, it's the most helpless I've ever felt because I couldn't see an end to it. And it seemed as though no matter what I said, nothing was being heard and it was going to be harm to my kids or the future or whatever. So that's what the despair is. It's just sort of the sense of there's no coming out of this. This is forever going to be a kind of a living hell. And it can change people can literally develop mental illnesses around that stress.
In today's day and age, saying you're busy, let's face it, is like a badge of honor. But even though you might not want to be, it's freaking hard to say no, especially to people you love and want to spend the time with, right? So even though you're spread so thin and feel freaking drained, you say yes to the baby shower, the birthday party, the reunion, the graduation, and host girls' night on top of all of that. But sometimes what we actually need is to slow down, recharge and spend time alone with us and our thoughts. That can also be quite scary to some people, and therapy can be the perfect opportunity to assess what you actually need so you can build a social life that doesn't actually drain your batteries. And guys, there's no easier or more convenient place to get started with therapy than BetterHelp. Therapy can be sometimes a little scary. It can be daunting, but BetterHelp is 100% online, and getting started is as simple as answering the few questions to be matched with a therapist that can actually help you the best. So find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/women today to get 10% off your first month. You can find the link in the show notes, guys, or you can go to BetterHelp, that's H-E-L-P.com/women. As an entrepreneur, one of the biggest challenges you will face is a negative voice in your head. You know who I'm talking about? That maybe not so small part of you that loudly doubts your abilities to actually pull the things off and make a living from your passion project. But you gotta overcome that negative voice in your head, homie, because I'm telling you, you can do it. Especially if you use Shopify. Now, Shopify is an all-in-one global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From launching your business to hitting $1 million, Shopify has got you completely covered. And with all the built-in Magic AI award-winning customer service and the internet's best converting checkout, you have everything you need to shut down the voice of doubt and make all your amazing business dreams a reality. That's exactly why, guys, I love Shopify. So if you want to start growing your business with more customers and sales, shut that negative voice down and prove her wrong that you can do it, Shopify is here for you. So go and sign up for just $1 a month with your trial period at shopify.com/Lisa, all lowercase. Again, guys, you can go to shopify.com/Lisa right now to grow your business, no matter where you are and what stage it's in. That's shopify.com/Lisa.
Did you ever feel that type of despair where you felt like, is this ever going to end?
Mm-hmm. All the time. Yeah. And I became very depressed, and I struggled with all kinds of issues like that because I didn't know what it was, Lisa. Mm. See, the one way the despair gets lifted a little bit is knowing what it is. It doesn't make it in a way any less hard. I mean, if somebody tells you why someone's screaming at you, they're still screaming at you. If somebody punched you in the face and told you this is why I punched you in the face, it still hurt, right? But it does help you understand, like, this isn't your fault. It's unfortunate, it's bad luck. And for some people, again, the despair is worse for people who can't get out, right? For financial reasons, for cultural and religious reasons, for reasons of fear of being alone because they really don't have support, that kind of thing. But the despair is very, very pronounced under those kinds of conditions because things can't get better. For some people, the despair is a catalyst. Like, they hit sort of a rock bottom, and you'll see sometimes survivors of narcissistic relationships do hit their rock bottom, whatever that looks like. And that getting to that bottom of despair for some of them is what ultimately motivates them to get out. For some people, it's what ultimately motivates them to be forever indifferent to the narcissistic person. I mean, I've worked with many people. Listen, LA is an interesting example. Real estate here is so expensive. So a lot of people can't afford to buy a home, or they can't afford rent. And there are people, I literally remember working with a woman who said, the two of us are living in this house. Each is waiting for the other to die. None of us is murderous, but whoever dies gets to keep the equity in the house. No, we cannot afford to, if we sold this house, even though they'd make a lot of money, those two halves wouldn't be enough to acquire housing and to be close to their work the way they needed. And if they left, they also couldn't afford rent. And so they're like, we're sticking it out. And she's like, he's got his part of the house. I've got my part of the house. We have times we both use the kitchen at different kinds of times. We have labeled our stuff in the refrigerator. If he dies, I get the house. If I die, he gets the house. And we're both waiting for the other one to die. Whoever dies first, the other one's the winner. She said that in as many words. She wasn't despairing. She's like, I know what I'm dealing with and it sucks. And we're here in LA. I'm like, you know, there's places in the country that are cheaper, but she still had a job. And I think she had grandchildren or something like that, that she wanted to be close to who are in the area. So she made a decision and she wasn't despairing. She was very matter of fact about it. You know, she said, is it inconvenient? I can't stand the man. I always know his schedule. So I'm always out of those rooms when he's there. So I don't even want to look at his face.
I don't like ever judging anyone. Live the life you want. But that sounds so unhealthy.
It is unhealthy and it can affect a person's health. But these are the kinds of bargains people are getting into because they're saying, I can't, like, and especially if you're older and saying, like, I'm going to run out of rent money at some point, right? And my retirement money won't pay the rent. Or, you know, if I take all the money and I put it into buying a small place, if I could, and they, like, there's nothing they could afford. They said there's no small place that exists at the price point that they've got. You see what I'm saying? So these are real, this is the reality of it. Like, it's, that's what I'm saying. I don't sugarcoat this. And I'm not going to sell some optimistic, like, everyone can go out and find their truth. And no, the real estate market is not going to support you in that. The world is not, family court's not going to support you in that. There's realities in this mess. And so that despair is partly a sort of a byproduct of the painful realities. The challenge with despair is if it has turned into, for example, major depressive disorder, a person needs care for that. They need to be treated for it. Depression is an illness. And like any illness, it needs to be treated. Otherwise, it's going to have more long-term effects on that person physically and mentally.
Yeah, as you've been breaking all of these down so eloquently, despair was the one that really hit me on that, like, oh God, is that at the point, like, does suicide go up when it's despair? And
And there are survivors who have, you know, gotten to that point. And that's what I'm saying. I really get tired of people minimizing what an issue this is, because this is a big, big issue. And if you haven't been through it and don't understand the helplessness and the almost like this, again, that nervous system freeze response, person doesn't know what to do. They don't feel empowered. They can't. There's so many reasons there is despair. But even for people who stay, like I said, that woman who's stuck staying, she said, we're not in a relationship. I don't talk to him. You know, it's, you know, it's just sort of a workaround. There's other people out there who say, we're in this together because we're still in this because it's just going to make it easier in some ways for grandchildren and all of that. Like, they're making choices for, and they said those grandchildren are the most important thing to me. Mm. So even though I can't stand living like this, seeing those grandchildren uplifts me like nobody's business. And so I'm able to get through another day with a narcissistic person. But they'll all say, in an ideal world, I would not be with this person. I wouldn't be living with them. And most of them say, and I won't give a damn when they die.
And part of me, like, actually, my heart bleeds a little more because it's like they're sacrificing again for something else. You're sacrificing for the grandkids. Mm-hmm. You're sacrificing for the kids. And it's like, God damn, when are we going to stop sacrificing for everybody else except for ourselves?
Mm-hmm. Right. But I mean, unfortunately, these relationships are often embedded in systems.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the challenge.
Yeah, I think that's where it becomes even harder. And talk to me about your three R's.
Right. So the three R's are rumination, regret, and we'll call it euphoric recall, R's for the recall. So start with rumination, because that's probably the most common fallout for people who have been who are in a narcissistic relationship or even coming out of it. It's rumination is the constant obsessive thinking and replaying of the relationship in your mind. It's over and over and over again. Now, rumination is an interesting thing. If rumination gets you to a solution, like sometimes if you really puzzle over something, let me think about this. And you can't let it go and you're like, oh, wait a minute, I have a solution. That's rumination doing what it could do. For a person in a narcissistic relationship, rumination will get you nowhere because there's no, right? The person's like, okay, I did. And then, but they said this, why did they say that? Like, wait a minute, what was on their phone? What time did their phone ping last night? But like they said, they were going to ruminate, because there's so much dishonesty in these relationships, so many breaches of trust, so much invalidation, so much shifting of the truth, gaslighting, all of that. You're chronically confused, so you ruminate. And rumination does so, again, it's not getting you to a solution. And when rumination doesn't get to a solution, that's where you see sort of more despair and sadness and all of that.
Because you're just sitting in it.
Because you're sitting in this dead loop that goes nowhere, right? But rumination also distracts people. When you're ruminating, you're in your head. So you're not paying attention to your work. You're not paying attention to other relationships in your life. You're not paying attention to caregiving responsibilities. Many people ruminating may not engage in good self-care. They're not taking the medications or taking care of their health or exercising or eating well. It's just churn, churn, churn. So they're missing out on their own lives because they're ruminating about this relationship. It is incredibly common in narcissistic relationships. It's a very common part of other mental illnesses too. Anxiety, depression, all have strong rumination components to them. But it is central in people who are experiencing narcissistic relationships or even healing from them. Sort of like, are they moving on? How do they get away with this? And the biggest thing that people ruminate about is injustice. This was so unfair. They're getting away with it. Our friends still speak to them. You know, their family still supports them. And they've moved on with someone else. They're already getting married to someone else. Like that part of it, the injustice piece is often a big blockade to people. Not only do they get stuck in the rumination, it can block their healing. The second R is regret. And these relationships are sort of a minefield of regret. People wishing they never met the person. People wishing they got out sooner. You know, people wishing they'd been born into a different family, whatever it may be. So the regret about what this did to a person's life. It's understandable because invariably anyone who's ever gone through a narcissistic relationship, it has harmed their life in some way. It has set them back. It has wasted time. It's caused internal wounds. It's caused them to doubt their own potential. Those are big wounds that stick with a person. So that regret, and if the growth doesn't help a person almost frame their regret in a context, like, this was my journey and I've learned, this is my journey and I now see I can be more discerning. It yielded the kids I want, whatever it may be. When the regret can't be contextualized, it can get stuck into the rumination. Those two things are related. Mm. And then the recall, especially the euphoric recall, is a problem. Narcissistic relationships are funny like this. If we look at some of the work on how people recall things, the memories we tend to hold on to more stridently are our negative memories. We remember bad stuff more than good stuff. And it makes sense evolutionarily. If we can remember where the poison berries are, we're not going to eat them again, or we're not going to harvest our berries from there.
Yeah.
If you look at our evolutionary history. Now that remembering bad things, we're like, okay, I'll remember not to go drive that way. It keeps us safe. The memory system was then being used as part of the sort of safety survival, like remember the bad stuff so we're not in danger.
Otherwise you keep touching the hot stove.
Correct. But we've evolved past that. And if you look at, you know, some of the, like Rick Hansen's work is a great example, who wrote Buddha's Brain. You know, he's like, part of meditative practice can we engage in recall of the good things in our life? You know, this is where we see practices like gratitude and, you know, reflecting on blessings in life. So here's where it gets interesting for survivors of narcissistic abuse. Heaven forbid we do anything in the right order, right? But the one thing that happens is, as part of the trauma bonding experience, people who are survivors or in these relationships or getting out of them selectively remember the good stuff. They will say, but we had a really great vacation in Miami 15 years ago. I remember working with one woman in therapy. She'd been married like 35, 40 years. Marriage was a disaster. I mean, the husband's a raging malignant narcissist. But the thing that kept coming up was, on our third date, we danced in the rain in Miami. If I had to listen to that Miami rain dance story one more time, thinking, this man has betrayed your trust in ways that I didn't even know you could betray trust. And that was what she kept going back to. But that euphoric recall, that perfect night, that perfect sunset, that perfect hotel, that perfect restaurant, you laugh and then the song that you were both talking about comes on, like, perfect. People get stuck in that. People go throw away 20 years of their life over one night.
If you're fed up of people constantly pushing you around, ignoring your boundaries, and just disrespecting you left, right, and center, then it's time to finally stop letting people walk all over you and start actually standing up for yourself, my homie. Because trust me, I've been there, staying silent and living a life I never actually wanted for myself, but lacked the confidence to do anything about it. But I was able to go from someone who settled and lacked all the confidence in herself to someone who comfortably commands respect. And guys, and my homie, even with the fears, the doubts, and uncertainty, you can finally go after what you freaking want in life, set boundaries, speak up, show up, fight imposter syndrome, and stop people pleasing. And I break down how to actually do this step by step in my book, Radical Confidence. And when you pre-order your copy of Radical Confidence right now today, guys, you can get a free gift valued at $171, which includes my ultimate guide to radical confidence, which is a workbook that you actually can work through as you're reading my book, 3 months ad-free listening to Women of Impact on podcast, and 1 hour exclusive relationship coaching sessions with me and my hubby of 21 years, Tom. So my homie, if you go and pre-order this book right now, you get all of those things for utterly free, which has been valued at $171. So go over to radicalconfidence.com to pre-order your copy right now. That's radicalconfidence.com. See you there, my homie. Let's freaking go.
And what is the brain doing? Like, is that also a protective mechanism? Like, if you're in a relationship that could be perceived as dangerous, the protective mechanism is holding on to that one happy moment so that it doesn't feel like always threat.
It's really part of the trauma bonding piece, the justification. It's a way to maintain the status quo. One way we understand narcissistic relationships is through the lens of something called cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is the tension or the discomfort in us that happens when all the pieces don't fit right. Right? Like, you find out that your friend is going to prison for embezzlement. Like, this is my best friend and they're going to prison for embezzlement. I'm like, oh, this doesn't feel good because the pieces don't fit. Mm-hmm. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So the in a narcissistic relationship, the cognitive dissonance is created by, and we had fun and we had these great dates and we are moved in together and they're really cute and they're super charming and they're so smart and they went to Harvard. They're really mean to me and they say terrible things to me and they keep flirting with my friend, but they're really hot. That's cognitive dissonance, right? That's attention. So how do we make cognitive dissonance go away? We make the pieces fit. And how do we make the pieces fit? We ignore that they're flirting with your friend and invalidating. We just focus on the stuff that allows us to stay in the relationship, to maintain the status quo. It's like the fox and the grapes, right? The fox couldn't get the grapes in the Aesop's fable. They were the most beautiful, juiciest grapes ever. And the way the fox was able to walk away was to tell himself that the grapes were probably sour. Otherwise, he would have to forever wonder, like, damn, I couldn't get to the grapes. And I'm so upset about that, right? That's not going to feel comfortable. Like, sour grapes. So in this case, it's a flip on that where it's sort of, we have a great relationship. It's really good. Yeah, flirt with my friend. My friend is kind of inappropriate. And so that's a her thing. And that thing he said to me, that was on a day he was really busy at work. Pieces fit. No more tension. And so all of that means that this to stay in the relationship, the person almost selectively has to pick out this good stuff. And then they get stuck in this euphoric recall loop, especially when it comes to go time, like the decision to leave the relationship or when the relationship has fallen apart. That can really kick in.
In real time, it's funny how I don't often think about my ex who was very, very verbally abusive. I'm not sure if he's technically a narcissist, but there was definitely a lot of things that we're talking about today has shown up in my relationship with him. And it was interesting because we were together for almost 4 years and it was just very turbulent, on, off, screaming matches, wild sex, like really just turbulent. And I remember once, Dr. Ramani, we were walking in the street and there was those, you know, those pillars, those like concrete things that cars don't go down the street. I remember this clear as day. We were walking by and we were holding hands and our hands broke because of the pillar. And so we like, you know, broke hands. And he's like, no, wait a minute. He backs up. He grabs my hand again and he's like, I don't want something concrete to get in between us. And we walk off. And I remember that to this day because I was like, that is the most romantic thing anyone's ever done.
That's right. That's right. Like I said, that's why I say people will lose 20 years over one night.
But that one little thing that you hold on to for the rest of the relationship, it's just insane. And I mean,
you believe you're not going to find it anywhere else, right? That it's such a special, evocative, you know, especially when people have magical thinking about that moment. Like, we met at 11-11 on 11-11.
Oh.
Or, you know, or like we kissed and there was a shooting star. Or, you know, the restaurant where we had our first date happened to be like whatever, some significant something or other. Like there's these magical moments will lead people to believe that this relationship was destined. And that destiny piece will also make people fight for this longer.
Oh, yeah, that never even dawned on me. So with the three R's that you just broke down, I can see how that can definitely keep us stuck. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about, I think you call it recovery of the lie. Is that right? Where you have to go back and look at moments where you were lying to yourself.
Yeah.
So I think there's a story about the photo from Italy.
Yeah. So, you know, this is it's recovering from the lie, right? That's what it was called in the book. And it's this idea that people start sort of messing with their own heads in these relationships. And they'll find a picture. Okay. And this, in the story I give in the book, is a story where the person finds a picture from a vacation to Italy. They look at the photograph and them and their partner were big smiles on this yacht, whatever, bright sunny day, sunburned, happy. The person remembers that it was on this trip that they started becoming suspicious that their partner was cheating on them. And upon coming home from the trip, in the months that followed, they came to find out that these pings and dings that they're hearing on the cell phone at all hours because of the time difference were actually because this person, their partner, was cheating on them even before the trip to Italy. So what happens is the person looks at that and will say, I don't even know if I was happy. What was I? But that moment when that picture was taken, you didn't know that this person was having an affair, right? This was before that you heard this, those cell phone pings, right? So as far as you're concerned, you're on this romantic trip of a lifetime to Italy. You're snuggling on this beautiful yacht in the Adriatic Sea. You're sunburned. You're glorious. You had sex that morning. That smile, you were happy in that picture. But in the background of that picture, in the backstory of that picture was at that time, your partner was already cheating on you. So it becomes the biggest mind, you know what, because you're like, I was smiling. He was cheating on me. I didn't know. And then I found out. The person doesn't even trust that. So the recovering from the lie is you were in Italy, you were happy in that picture, and then it all fell apart. You were working on what you had, and it's just helping people see, because people then doubt their entire history. And it's hard for people to say, like, I was in a relationship and it was really great until I found out that they had cheated on me four times in four different ways. I'm going to give you the example of someone who, actually, I hope you have on the show one day, actually, is a woman named Jen Faison, okay? Jen Faison had a very popular podcast called Betrayal, and then a Hulu series by the same name on her experience of betrayal. And the one thing Jen says that sticks with me, and she's an amazing, interesting, fascinating, wonderful woman, was the level of betrayal. Anyone who's watched the Hulu show will know why I'm saying this, and I don't want to give away the punchline if you ever talk to her. The betrayal Jen experienced, and I've been doing this for a long time, was the greatest betrayal I had ever heard. And she said, until the day the betrayal got discovered, by the way, involved law enforcement, and that's how she found out about the betrayal. So until the day the betrayal was shown, she was convinced she was an extraordinarily happily married woman. No red flags, no sense anything was wrong, no like, oh, these are all the problems. She thought she was happily married. And then this all was unveiled. So this is not uncommon for people to go through, not at the level she did, obviously, but people to be in a relationship and believe they're happy, then find out something else, look back at the pictures and really say, what the hell was I? And you were working with the facts you had and you were having an experience, right? And it's an experience, and your experience is based on the context and what you believe the context to be. And on that day you were happy, and that's a fact. Mm. Now, when you look at that picture, you may feel sad, but you feel sad now. Mm-hmm. You weren't sad then. You were, and it's sort of like bringing people back to, because it's about doubting your whole history. And if you doubt your whole history, you become really destabilized. You know, you can only feel what you feel. And as the information comes in, you're feeling changed. It would be one thing then if the person said, I'm still happy. I look at that picture in Italy and I'm still happy, even though I knew he was cheating on me. Well, then we need to talk. Yeah. But it's not unusual to look back and say, I don't know what I was feeling. I'm like, oh, you're smiling big. And the person might say, actually, no, I was smiling big, but I wasn't happy. I was miserable. And so you could own that too. The example I give in the book, the person didn't yet know the person was cheating on them or had just learned that they were cheating on them. Yeah.
So do you advise them to try, as if you can, hold on to that memory as being good?
No, it's understanding, because what people do, it's not that they want to remember the memory as good, is they look back and say, my whole life was a lie.
Right.
And your whole life wasn't a lie. You were, with what you had at the time, you were having an experience.
But right? You perceive it as it was a lie.
You know, you perceive it as a lie. A person will say, I look back at that really, really poignant moments, like the being in the delivery room with your partner, the partner who might have subsequently cheated on you a week after you got out of that delivery room. That moment when your child was put in your arms and you were with that child's parent, you were happy in that moment. That's a fact. Don't doubt that experience. Because when you doubt that, you're more apt to doubt yourself in current time.
How that do was you happy. Doubt that in that moment?
Because you look at the picture and say, I was happy that day.
So you just need to reorient mm-hmm. yourself to what
but
you
I'm
felt
not
that
happy
day.
Now. Yeah, that day I was happy. Baby came, you know, baby was healthy. We were excited. And that way, and then the next week I found out news that would blow up my world. If you took a picture of me that day, I wouldn't have been so happy.
But separating the two, I think would be very difficult, but I can totally see why that would be super empowering. Because the idea that your whole history is a lie is hard to swallow.
Correct. And it destabilizes you in present time because you don't trust yourself anymore. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that would be the hardest thing is that as you're taking the next photo in the now, you're smiling and like, you would start to question, am I going to look back at this photo and wonder? And now you're just in your own head and spiraling.
Right, rumination.
Yeah, there you go. All the way back to rumination. Yeah. You're right. Dr. Ramani, as always, girl, I can speak to you forever. Where can people find you and your amazing book, It's Not You?
So again, in the beauty of this conversation, we haven't even begun to hit the top of all the stuff on healing here. There's much, much more than we talked about. So please, anywhere you buy your books, Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore, Target, Amazon, wherever you want, you can get this book. And you can also find me at drramani.com on YouTube, where we have new content every single day. A lot of it mirrors what's on the book, but a lot of it is just sort of a daily reflection on what's happening in the world of narcissism. We also, if you want to do a deeper dive into healing, I have a healing program, monthly healing program for people who really want to do journaling and have sort of a support mechanism and workshops and all of that. You can find all of that on my website.